TFM.
Welcome, Boomers, to another episode of Warp 5, our dedicated Enterprise podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, before we get started, could I ask you to just bring your mic level up to 40%?
Chris, I'm a little worried that if I do that, it's going to get a little bit crazy in here.
Yeah, well, let's just try it. Shut it down. Shut it down.
I told you, Chris.
I know. Creating a stable audio field isn't easy,
Matthew. Not anymore.
As many podcasters know. So, all right, everyone. We are going to be continuing our 20th anniversary rewatch of Enterprise today. This is Anomaly. It's the second episode of season 3. And here is a very quick rundown of the story. Things in the Expanse get weirder and more dangerous as an anomaly starts rearranging Enterprise, and an unexpected visit from a group of alien pirates complicates matters and threatens to leave the crew stranded. Porthos knew it was going to be a bad day when he saw a book on the floor, but he didn't realize just how bad it would get. To keep the mission on track, Archer has to resort to more extreme measures, including torture. In the process of retrieving their supplies, the crew of the NX-01 uncovers an even deeper mystery, an ancient sphere. And to find it, they just had to follow Jenny. So, Matthew, I don't know if you noticed, but in the graphic where they're following the ion trail of the Osarian ship, one of the coordinates, 8675309.
That I did not notice, but that is really funny. And I love that that is the type of humor that the writers of Enterprise like to insert behind the scenes. And, so you have to really be paying attention for those type of Easter eggs. That's hysterical.
I love that that's in there. And they show it more than once as well, because they use the same graphic more than once. So. That's excellent. It's like a cosmic bathroom wall, right?
Exactly. I mean, and now we know where they ended up, you know?
Exactly. So, well, speaking of that big cosmic canvas, that's, I guess, a good starting point for the core of this story. What strikes me about Anomaly as we really start the Expanse story and the search for the Zindi is just how the writers are able to use the Expanse as this big canvas where they can tell new yet familiar stories that could be at home on other Star Trek series that are set in familiar Federation space. Like, I could see this happening on The Next Generation, for example. And it's similar to a couple of Voyager episodes, The Void and Concerning Flight, where the crew has their supplies stolen. And then there's also Twisted, where there's like this inversion field that starts distorting Voyager. Reminds me of that a bit at the beginning as well. But the stakes are a lot higher here, and they're able to introduce new things they could not do in familiar spaces easily.
Yeah, I think that, you know, with the Expanse, the thing that we really get that makes this different is the fact that we're in a place which is inherently dangerous. And therefore, it ups the ante for what we're going through. Because, you know, if you were going through this situation in a normal, you know, Star Trek episode, you know, you're just in normal space, you're on kind of an exploratory mission, you're not going to have this response to what happens.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, right.
Because you're not under pressure. You know, I mean, I guess everybody's listening to Queen in this episode, you know,
yeah.
Under pressure. But that, I mean, we clearly see the pressure that all of these characters are under because of what they're going through and the mission that they're on. And so everything is just ramped up to like 20 on okay. a level of 10.
So you know? Way past 11 right here.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Way past 11. And I think everybody portrays that right in the episode. Archer is on edge. Everybody is on edge. And I think, you know, again, that's what takes a story that feels somewhat familiar in any Star Trek series and makes it specifically an episode that fits within Enterprise season 3 because of all the extenuating circumstances that have happened to this crew.
Right. Yeah, it's something that I feel like if I think back to when this first aired, and my own reaction, and especially the reaction of the fan base overall to it being different from past Star Trek. And I remember some people saying, and maybe I even said this myself, that it didn't quite feel like Star Trek because we were used to this certain style of storytelling. And then here, the introduction of elements that were less familiar, the removal of elements that were familiar, especially in terms of aliens, and the introduction of the Mako and Archer's reaction here, of course, as a captain, were things that felt a bit odd. But when I look back at it now, I realize how it sort of opened up Star Trek to kind of revitalize the storytelling a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that idea really makes sense. And I'm glad that you pointed that out, because what's interesting is that what I think is happening is them actually picking up threads that Deep Space Nine had used. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of being pushed to the brink and the idea of an impending war or an impending doom. You know, I think all of that fits perfectly within what we get with, of course, Star Trek Deep Space Nine. But I think what makes it so interesting here, and what I like about the storytelling, is that this does feel more raw and more real and more present for those of us who had, you know, of course, just been through 9/11 and all that when this came out. Mm-hmm. But I think also it feels much more raw and real because these characters are much more like us.
Yeah.
They're much right. closer to who we are, because this is the first time they've been out in space, right? Mm-hmm. And so therefore, the only thing that they have really to challenge isn't the Star Trek ideal, it's the human ideal that we know that they're striving for, and what's going to happen to get them there, you know, and how is this going to be possibly a bump in the road to getting them there? I think all that is the stuff that makes this really fascinating. And like you said, some of it feels familiar, but and it is with Deep Space Nine and all those type of things, but it's also virgin territory in the sense that this is virgin territory for the characters, right? They have never been in an experience like this. And so I love this because I was also thinking about, you know, this is what happens. Like, all of these characters, they're not sleeping. They're not probably eating well, you know.
Well, Tripp's only slept an hour, he said.
Exactly. And they're in a situation which is causing intense emotional stress at like they're just living on adrenaline and that ruins people, right? That hurts people. And so I really appreciate this episode dealing with that so honestly. And what's crazy is the season just started, Chris.
Exactly. Yeah, we're just jumping into it. So another thing about this episode is that the aliens, the Osarians that come aboard Enterprise, one of them's captured, and so we get to learn a little bit more about them. And one thing that we learn is they weren't always like this. They are from outside the expanse. Phlox points that out to Archer, that he recognizes their species, and they're not from the expanse. And Archer learns that the expanse changed these people. They've been trapped here. They've had to revert to piracy and killing just to survive. It reminds me of the comment, I believe it's on DS9, right? Where they talk about when you strip away all the comforts of what humans are accustomed to, they become just as primal as anyone. And that's what the Enterprise crew is facing, being trapped in the expanse. And if they weren't able to get their supplies back here, they could easily turn into what these Osarians have become. And an interesting thing about the aliens in here is that in the original drafts of this episode, the original scripts, they weren't Osarians, they were Orions. So we have a familiar race who became trapped in the expanse. And Mike Sussman thought that the expanse might be a way to add texture to the Star Trek universe and show that Orions weren't always pirates, but the experience in the expanse caused some Orions to turn to piracy. And I thought that was interesting thinking about it now after that we've had Lower Decks, because we had the episode, the crossover with Strange New Worlds in Lower Decks. And there's the bit about, you know, Tendi's talking about how you shouldn't assume that all Orions are pirates, right? So there's this kind of backstory to the Orions, perhaps, that was never told. And Sussman thought about doing it here, but in the end, they ended up changing the name of the aliens and obviously the makeup as they went through drafts of the story.
Yeah, I think that it was wise for them not to do Orions mm-hmm. because we immediately have a connotation about them.
Yeah.
Whereas I think the realization that these aliens who we don't know tell us, you know, hey, this wasn't always us, right? You know, we've been driven to this because of the place that we're stuck in and we can't get out. Mm-hmm. And I think the beauty of that then is that we see that, okay, if they're telling the truth, then we have to worry about what our characters might become. And so 100%, I think mm-hmm. that it is the right choice to not do the Orions, because it would be too easy to negate that message mm-hmm. in this episode
yeah.
if it was a race that we already know to be dubious at best.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting idea to portray them as not being that way in the 22nd century.
Sure,
but like you say, as viewers, we come into it with this preconception of what Orions are, which is Tindy's whole point on Lower Decks, is that, you know, people just assume that all Orions are like that, but they're not. But in the context of this story, yeah, I think the message would have been lost if we had encountered Orions from the start. Whereas what we get here with the Osarians is them holding up a mirror to the Enterprise crew to offer them a glimpse of what they could become if they let the expanse get them and change them. And we see that a bit in Archer himself, where he is determined to get the supplies back, first of all, because he has to keep the mission to find the Zindi going. But, you know, we see Archer just, you know, unleash this anger and determination and frustration. His patience is growing shorter and shorter. And here he actually locks an Osarian in the airlock and almost suffocates him to force him to reveal information. So we've got a Starfleet captain torturing a prisoner to get information. And already you can see Archer as an example of how quickly the expanse can, like, push you to become something that you never thought you could become.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it is such an interesting thing, because I think the beauty of this is you completely understand Archer's thought process here, which mm-hmm. is, we have no idea what's in this expanse. We have no idea what we're going to find. We are one ship, and we are tasked with saving our entire planet. We don't have time to be, you know, messing around, because we legitimately don't know what the timeline is. You know, mm-hmm. we don't have time to talk about time, because we don't have the time, right?
Exactly.
And so I think that's the, like, when I'm watching this episode and I'm thinking through everything from Archer's point of view, and from trying to put myself in his shoes as this captain, where the weight of the world has been rested upon your shoulders, quite literally, in some ways, right? Like, it's almost not figurative. It feels pretty literal. And so you understand then why he's just so ready to snap the moment where he gets this information that they've run into a Zindi and they have this database, and it could help him possibly get this mission over quicker. And you see that when he's in sick bay and he sees the two dead crew members.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. And you know what he's thinking, which is, this is just a foretaste of what could happen. And we've already seen it with Florida. Here's two more added to the ledger. I can't keep letting this happen. And so what I think is great about the writing in this episode, and even just, it's not even just the writing, but it's the subtle cues that are giving throughout the entire episode to see the reasons why Archer's own threat level reaches midnight. You know, that's right, Michael Scott. Threat level midnight is happening in Archer. And it is kind of a scary thing to see our captain do this, right? And I think, in all honesty, the only other captain that we've kind of see even get close to this is the type of thing we saw, you know, Sisko do in A Pale Moonlight, right? Where really pushing those moral boundaries for the quote unquote greater good. And I think that's the beauty of this season is, well, again, we're kind of testing all of those things that we've said Star Trek is. And I really appreciate that so far, just even in this episode.
Well, and like Sisko, Archer can live with it because he has to save Earth. And I feel also that you mentioned 9/11 earlier, and of course it's very well known that this season grew out of those events, either directly or indirectly, just because of the feeling. We've talked about it, I think, during this rewatch, the feeling of Americans after that event. And I think that's reflected here in the feeling of the people of Earth after the Zindi attack, and how the event sort of changes your view of your place in the world, in the case of the US, in the galaxy, in the case of Earth, in this story. And there's this feeling of being on guard. There's this sense of urgency that takes hold. And you certainly see that with Archer and really the whole crew here. And of course, the Makos being on the ship are part of that. We do get a lot more Mako action, with a dash of sexy in this episode, but you can see why the Makos are here, because if Archer and his crew had encountered the Osarians in this situation without the Makos on the ship, do you think they would have survived the encounter?
You know, I think that Reed's security team could have handled it, but I do think that having a fighting force like the Makos, whose sole role is this, makes much more sense. Because, you know, all of those security officers on board Enterprise most likely have other jobs on the ship. And so, and then because we, I think there are like 87 crew members without Makos on the, on the Enterprise, which means that you know, as security, you probably have dual roles when, you know, you're in space and you're not.
Yeah, because most of the time you're not under threat, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so, and especially in the situation they're in, where they're also trying to repair the ship, what's happened, all of those things, right? And so, no, I 100% agree with you. I think this is a place where, you know, bringing the Makos on board is again legitimized, the decision that Archer has made. And I think they really prove their mettle, right? The reasons why you would want them here, and they're glad they're here. And so, and I actually kind of really loved that scene, because you mentioned the sexy aspect of it, but it has nothing to do with that. What it really had came down to was it felt so realistic to a military operation where that doesn't even enter people's minds, especially when they know they're about to go on a mission. Like, everybody's just getting ready, and there's that sense of like egalitarianism that kind of comes into that too. It's like everybody is just you're getting dressed. Like, there's something very real about that. And I just kind of loved, too, Archer, these aren't, quote unquote, his people, right? You know, they're not a part of Starfleet. And yet, what is he doing? He's trying to take care of them by explaining what it's going to be like to go on an alien ship, to kind of prep them as best as he can, to get them psyched for this mission in a way that is going to allow them to be able to handle this. Because, you know, we've seen the first time that some people have gone on missions over the first couple of seasons and it not end up so well, especially like with Hoshi, right? And so any one of these people could have that reaction too, because they've never been out in deep space. They've never confronted hostile aliens of this nature like this. So I just thought all of that was really, really well done. And again, it's one of those places where it does show you how much Archer has grown as a commander, and he puts aside, you know, any kind of us versus them mentality between the Makos and Starfleet. No, they're all on the same team here, and he's treating them as if they were, you know, any part of his crew in Starfleet, which is exactly what he should be doing, because they all are under his command. And so therefore, in many ways, they all are his people.
Well, yeah, they all are the crew at this point when they're out here together. You know, we should point out that the Makos also have no experience with threatening aliens like this either, because no one's been out this far before. But the difference between them and, say, the standard security crew on the Enterprise, who does have other responsibilities, is I feel the Mako would have been much more thoroughly trained for unexpected hostile encounters and are able to approach that in a more professional way, where their training guides them and they're less likely to react to the novelty of the situation because they've been well trained to expect the unknown and to, you know, follow their training, follow procedures and handling it in a way that someone who's not as specialized might not have been trained as thoroughly.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more.
So another thing in this episode, and this one actually I had forgotten until rewatching, that this is the moment when the crew encounters a sphere for the first time. And the spheres, of course, become a central part of the mystery of the Expanse and the Zindi attack. So what do you think about this aspect of the story, introducing a 1,000-year-old mystery to a story that's already quite layered, and they're just piling on another one here?
You know, obviously we're looking at this in retrospective because this is a 20th anniversary rewatch. And I think what this actually does is remind me that this season is pretty well thought out for the most part. And so the fact that you're introducing this part of the mystery, which the spheres are going to be a massive part of this story, is kind of crazy. I mean, I remember obviously seeing it the first time and just kind of thinking to myself, oh, a Star Trek Death Star type thing? Ooh, that's fascinating.
It reminded me of a Dyson sphere a little bit, especially with the little doors they have to go through.
Exactly. So, you know, there's a couple of things that we've already done in sci-fi that we all love that we've seen even in Star Trek. And so, but
then you get inside and it's like, hey, we discovered a giant warehouse.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
We can stuff all of our junk that we don't have space for in here.
Yeah, maybe this is just a 1,000-year-old storage unit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
And no one's been paying the monthly rent on it either. The stuff's just been abandoned inside there for 1,000 years.
Space storage wars. Oh, man. I'll give you 25 bricks of gold-pressed platinum.
I'll take that rations pack. What's the expiration date on there? 827 years ago. I think it still smells okay.
But yeah, I mean, I think it works, and I think it's a smart move here. And again, to knowing exactly where the spheres are going to go as a part of the story, I think it was good to introduce this early. And it's something to which, sometimes, you know, when you're doing shows or whatever, and you're doing a lot of continuity in the shows, it does feel like it's almost like they're afraid to introduce things and start answering any questions at any time soon, you know, but like first episode, we already introduced the fact that there are five Zendi species and now we're introducing the spheres, right? So we've answered a couple of questions and now we're adding some more layers. It's like, it's to me so far in a continuous storytelling nature, we're doing a good job. And so it'll be interesting. I think the most interesting thing to track this season is where are there any places where it's like, oh, okay, I can see where you're, it feels like you're having to add an episode in and it might not necessarily be necessary to the story, but what they're doing here, I think, is really setting up, again, the threat level that, that we're facing, from unknown aliens who might attack us to anomalies that we seem to have no control over stopping, to the laws of physics not even working.
Exactly. Yeah, the Cochrane equation is not constant in The Expanse. Yeah, I think like you said earlier, it feels like the story was thought out quite well from the start. And so they know these are the pieces that are going to be important to this story and the mystery and what is needed to unravel the mystery. And so let's introduce them early and then play with them as we go. Because often you watch TV shows where there's some kind of mystery and then halfway through or sometimes three quarters of the way through, they suddenly introduce some new element. And it feels like, oh, okay, well, that's convenient that now this is here. And you do feel like the writers, they're in a corner, like, how do we get out of this? So they introduce some new thing. I mean, if you take Lost, one reason that I soured on Lost as the seasons went on is that it became very evident that they're just making stuff up as they go and they have no real idea where this story was headed. And I like this situation here where I feel like it does take time to unravel the mystery, but we get the important pieces up front so that it feels like we're following the crew through a more natural process. Another, like a Star Trek example that comes to mind for me is the second season of Discovery, which I overall enjoyed, especially because of Anson Mount being on there as Pike. But I thought the story itself was interesting, but I felt like they resolved what should have been the mystery about two-thirds of the way through that season. And then they had to have an additional mystery tacked on to that. And I thought it wasn't paced particularly well. And again, this is a case where I think it ends up being paced well because it's set up to, it's set up in the beginning to be resolved in the way that they really want it to be resolved so that it climaxes at the end and not before.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a great point.
So one other thing I wanted to mention in here that I like about this episode and just what Enterprise is doing is that Enterprise inherited from Deep Space Nine primarily the idea of more continuity in Star Trek, where things that happen in one episode carry through to the next episode. We've seen it in very subtle ways, like Malcolm injuring his leg and then that being carried over into the next episode. And here we get a little bit of that with Phlox and Tripp's conversation and talk about the neuropressure with T'Pol. Again, we're doing a rewatch, so we know where this is going to go with Tripp and T'Pol, and we've seen it introduced here at the beginning of the season. And I like that they're able to keep that momentum going without that having to actually be part of the story.
Right. Yeah, I could agree with you more. I think it's one of those places where the writers are doing a great job to keep us keyed in to the important storylines. And, you know, I think the beauty here is, like you said, you're actually mentioning the fact that Tripp is still having trouble sleeping and all of these things, and you're doing it in a slightly different way. So we're not just going down the exact same road that we already were on. And the fact that he has been, you know, doing these things with T'Pol to help and everything. And yet at the same time, he's also feeling like, and the thing that I kind of love about it is I get this feeling as though Trip is like, I can't keep spending this much time in T'Pol's quarters, as if like, one, it's frustrating to have to go to her quarters every night to feel like he can get to sleep, right? Because it takes mm-hmm. time. And two, I feel like, you know, as with most people, you know, Trip is probably a person who doesn't like to feel like he's putting people out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can get the feeling that he would probably feel that way about what's he's needing in some ways from T'Pol in this. And so it just creates this awkward, interesting dynamic. You know, Enterprise has already, I think, done a good job of allowing our characters to grow and that growth to continue from episode to episode. And this season, it's just kind of taking what Enterprise had already been doing, I think, and ramping that up. And that's the thing I kind of love about this season, is that it just gets to really, I think, play with the things that Enterprise had already been trying to do in some ways, but then really make it more a part of its identity, which is awesome.
Yeah, definitely. So let's close out with a little bit of trivia. And this is something I wanted to bring up because we talked about it last episode. We talked about the name change of the show from Enterprise to Star Trek Enterprise. And in preparing for this one and, you know, doing some research and such, I was reminded of something that I had forgotten about, which is that actually this episode is the last episode of the show to air before the name change. So It's actually the next episode from which the show changes its name to Star Trek Enterprise. And one reason I forgot about it is because even the Blu-rays start season 3 with Star Trek Enterprise in the title credits.
Mm-hmm.
So now I need to go back and try to find. I have the DVDs, although I think they're the same. I think they also have Enterprise from the start of season 3. So I want to go back and try to find some footage of the originals when they aired on UPN to see the title sequence. If it's Enterprise, it must be Enterprise in the Expanse mm-hmm. and in Anomaly.
Right.
And I think that's really interesting that they weren't able to make that change from the start of season 3, given the time gap between seasons and you're going in. And one other interesting point about the name change is that throughout the remainder of the series, all the way through to the end of season 4, the scripts refer to the show as Enterprise, not Star Trek Enterprise. So the writers and the executive producers are pretty much telling the studio, if you want to slap it on the screen, you think it makes a difference, go ahead, but it's not the name of the show.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it is funny to me because it isn't necessarily Star Trek yet.
Right.
Because there isn't a Federation.
Yeah.
And, I mean, gosh, even rewatching the original series with my wife, I think that the first time that it's called Starfleet Command actually might be in continuity. And I could be wrong because we've been watching it kind of slowly, but we just rewatched, and I showed her for the first time City on the Edge of Forever.
Mm-hmm.
And Kirk, at the beginning of the episode, is talking to Uhura, and he says, "Alert Starfleet Command." And I believe it's the first time that he's ever uttered the phrase Starfleet Command.
Well, it isn't Starfleet in the beginning. There are a number of terms used. United Space Agency is one. You know, it took them a while to kind of settle on what their terminology was going to be.
Right. And so, but all that to say, this is a different show in the sense that it isn't quite the same as the other Star Treks because it doesn't have all of the things that we know of as Star Trek, and hence calling it Enterprise, because Enterprise was the thing that led us to the Star Trek universe we all know. And that was kind of the genius of the thought process.
Yeah.
So, yes, it just goes to show how ridiculous studio executives can be.
Well, and also just the word Enterprise itself is what's going on, right? It's humanity. It's an enterprise to go out into space and eventually develop the Federation. To me, it was always very intentional to not have Star Trek in the title for the reason that you're describing, is that this is what leads to Star Trek, and dropping those words from the name actually was part of the concept of the show. That's the story that we were telling. And yeah, so I always prefer it without the word Star Trek in there. But at any rate, I find it interesting that we have to get a few episodes into season three before that studio decision actually takes place. All right. Well, so what are your final thoughts, and what's your rating for Anomaly?
I think this is a great episode, Chris. I think it does an excellent job of ramping up the tension from the first episode of the season. And I think it does a good job as well of setting expectations of what is to come this season for this crew and what is at stake, right? It's not just humanity, but it is our very humanity that's at stake. And will we lose our humanity to try and save it? And that's a great question, and it makes this a fantastic episode. In all honesty, I think I have to give this 4.75 out of 5 floating cups of coffee. Which, by the way, I absolutely adore that they're using the Voyager, you know, mug here. So my thought process is that Catherine Janeway is a really big fan of Archer and his crew. And so she had her favorite coffee cups programmed into the replicator on Voyager, because that's how she wanted coffee cups to appear, just like her favorite captain.
I think so. She's an Uber fan. And in my headcanon, she actually bought Captain Archer's actual mug off of the eBay It's a Wrap auction, where someone also bought Corporal McKenzie's EV undersuit that was worn by actress Julia Rose for $201.50 during that auction from this episode. So that's part of my headcanon. But yeah, Janeway, she's definitely a Star Trek Uber fan, no doubt. All right. I mean, I've shared my thoughts on this episode. I agree with you. I think it's a really great episode for what it says about humanity. It's that core question that Star Trek and science fiction can ask when it's at its best. And, you know, there are aspects of the story where I think some things are kind of routine or maybe a bit familiar. But I think what it does for the season three story, for the search for the Zindi and for humanity's path towards the Federation, I think it's a very good story. So I'm going to give it 8 thick single-use tablets, because I love that in this episode, Trip is studying the engines and he's got 4 big tablets in front of him on the table. And so, again, they seem to be basically like books, just like they still are in the 24th century when Picard has to pile them up on his desk when he needs to study something. So I tell you, we are way ahead of Star Trek when it comes to tablet functionality. All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Anomaly. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's a closed group, so if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. We do that because we want the group to be for listeners, not just for, you know, general random things on Facebook, as so many groups are, so that we can continue the discussions from the podcast. Extend those over to Facebook. You'll see a post on the timeline for this episode. You can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. And we'd love to hear your thoughts. And you can also send us email if you like. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show. Choose Warp 5, and that will come to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we would love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not angering Aldebaran mud eels as you roll over in your sleep, where can people find you?
Oh, gosh. Would they leave me alone? You can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02 here on the network. Outside of this show, you can find me in the 602 Club talking about all of those franchises we love outside of Star Trek. You can also find me doing The Orb, Artificial Tango, and Saddle Up, as well as sometimes on Literary Treks. So check all of those out. And over on the Nerd Party Network, you'll find me with two shows. One is called Owl Post with Drea Kaufman about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we are talking about Star Wars each and every week. Now, Chris, when you're not trying to figure out how in the world a ship can hit an anomaly and have everything roll, but have nothing really affected structurally, where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm working on that. I've got a stack of thick pads in front of me right now, and I'm trying to figure out how that works. But yeah, when I'm not doing that, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing all of these shows with you. You can also find me in past episodes across the network over the past 14 years. Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time. And you can also find me on social media. I'd love to chat with you there. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. So I'd love to chat with you wherever you are. And if you would like to help us keep this rewatch and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help to find out how to support the network and how to get involved. Please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/TrekFM. We would not be here without your support. So thank you to everyone who is supporting the network right now. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to de-evolving with you next time as we talk about extinction.
Well, I guess that sounds exciting. Let's go. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out just what underwear to wear,
I'm going to wear the ones I bought off eBay, Matthew.